the culverts have been opened, reopened. They were blocked, and so there was a lot of water coming right over the road.
Repairing the rain-damaged road into Denali Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new public access to data helps Anchorage schools develop solutions.
There were already discussions going between principals about what's happening at that school versus this school, the very things we want to have happen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
State regulators are monitoring the cleanup of two small oil spills at a storage site on the west side of Cook Inlet. The spills were discovered at the Drift River Terminal facility, which is owned by the Cook Inlet Pipeline Company, a subsidiary of Hillcorp Alaska. Young Ha of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says the spills were found after the company began emptying two tanks for a once-a-decade inspection in late June. Operators mistakenly transferred the oil through a fill line into the wrong tank.
Apparently, in the past, no one knew that it was actually going into the 20-inch fill line. And I guess all this time it was, that no one caught that over, you know, it looks like several decades.
All told, the company estimates about 28 gallons of oil contaminated the ground, but Ha says that could change.
You have to really dig it up, dig up the soil. You know, it could be more, it could be less.
Ha says so far there isn't any evidence that the nearby Drift River was contaminated or that any wildlife was affected. Hillcorp bought the facility from Chevron in 2011. No one from the Cook Inlet Pipeline Company or Hillcorp returned calls today. The National Park Service continues work to repair a mudslide damaged portion of the road into Denali National Park. A mudslide last Saturday initially blocked the road at mile 67 west of the Eielson Visitor Center. The Park Service opened one lane of the road on Sunday, but passage has been restricted so crews can continue repairs. Park spokeswoman Lynn McAloon says the agency hopes to have the road fully open by Friday.
The one thing that really needed to happen that has happened now is that the culverts have been opened, reopened. They were blocked, and so there was a lot of water coming right over the road. So the road itself was being channeled out by the water for a little while. Now that they've been able to divert that water back into the culverts, there's the ability to be able to repair the road now.
McAloon stresses repair operations hinge on the weather, noting that the area has received extreme rainfall, including more than 16 inches last month, which has supersaturated the fine-grained volcanic soils. A Skagway Borough Assembly member and businessman convicted of failing to file his income tax returns has been ordered to spend a year and a day in prison. KTOO's Matt Miller has more on the story.
61-year-old Dan Henry, operator of the Skagway Fish Company, will spend a year on supervised release after he gets out of prison. He must also pay over $600,000 in restitution to the federal government for unpaid back income taxes. In a written statement to the court, Henry said alcoholism led to his dismissal from early jobs at the Chicago Board of Trade and a DUI conviction. He also blamed heavy drinking for gambling away all of the money he set aside for the 2005 season start of the Skagway Fish Company restaurant and the payment of taxes. He put off filing his income taxes as he repeatedly returned to Las Vegas with the hope of winning his money back, but the losses simply compounded over the years. Henry also wrote that he worked hard, long hours to build up the Skagway Fish Company, but there's no one else to replace him and fill his multiple roles at the business. He ends his letter by apologizing for his conduct and acknowledging that he must make restitution as soon as possible. U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Burgess on Monday ordered Henry to a year in prison for each of the three charges to be served concurrently. For the fourth charge, Henry will spend a day in prison to be served consecutively to the other terms. Henry, whose current term on the Skagway Borough Assembly ends in October of 2017, must report to a federal prison facility by this November. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, teaching earthquake preparedness with a simulator.
It's one of those things that we've been very fortunate, but you certainly want to be prepared.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Denali National Park's long-studied and once popularly viewed East Fork Wolf Pack is likely no longer. Several members of the Park Entrance Area Wolf Group have been killed on state land. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the famed pack status is unknown.
Denali's East Fork Wolf Pack declined to just one known female and two pups earlier this summer. That after the pack's last other member, a radio-collared male, was spotted dead at a hunting camp on state land off the Stampede Trail in May. Park Service wildlife biologist Bridget Borg says it's impossible to know for sure if the mother wolf and her pups survived after her mate's death, but there's been no recent sign of the animals, and their den appears empty.
We investigated the den site after there was clear evidence it was not being used, as evidenced by vegetation that was growing around the entrance to the den site.
The apparent demise of the East Fork Pack comes amidst a broader, steep decline of park-based wolves to around 50 animals. The low point is attributed to more than human harvest outside the park, but it appears to be a significant mortality factor for entrance area wolves. Borg points to the human-caused deaths of three of four East Fork Pack radio-collared animals in the last year.
If we just look at the collared wolf mortalities for this pack, 75% died as a result of snaring or being shot. So this is really high compared to our, you know, previously published rate of less than 20%.
They're allowing a handful of people to gun them down or trap them. I mean, it's really... we feel it's a scandal.
Sean McGuire is with the small Fairbanks-based advocacy group Alaskans for Wildlife. He says the loss of Denali's East Fork Pack takes with it valuable opportunity for park entrance area wolf viewing, as well as a lot of history.
This wolf pack has been probably the most viewed wolf pack in world history. It's been studied continuously for 70 years. This was the pack that Adolf Murray originally wrote the classic Wolves of Mount McKinley.
The park's Borg agrees it's unfortunate to lose track of the long-tenured and well-followed East Fork group.
But we should note that the potential loss of this pack doesn't really mean the loss of the lineage of these wolves. For example, the Riley Creek pack was actually founded by an East Fork female. And this summer, one of her pups has dispersed and apparently found a mate and appears to be eking out a new territory along the park road corridor between Toklat and Wonder Lake.
State wildlife officials point to robust wolf populations outside Denali. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Darren Bruning says the agency has no confirmation of the May East Fork wolf kill, as its radio collar has not been turned in. Bruning says with no other conclusive information about the pack's status, there's no reason for action.
Hunting and trapping along the northeast boundary of the national park and the Stampede Trail area is the purview of the Alaska Board of Game. The Department of Fish and Game would take no action unless directed by the Board of Game.
The Game Board agreed earlier this year to shorten the spring wolf hunt along Denali's northeast edge and will consider proposals to reinstate a former no-wolf kill area there at a spring 2017 meeting. McGuire says he has no faith in the board and wants the governor to step in and close the Stampede area to wolf harvest. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Anchorage School District is about to get a lot more transparent. Data about discipline, achievement, absenteeism, and more will be easily searchable by district decision makers and the public. And the administration is using it to craft solutions. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
Want to know how many students received suspensions at your kid's school? Which group of students is doing the best at reading? How many kids passed Algebra 1? It used to take hours to dig up these bits of information. Now, it's a couple of mouse clicks. The Anchorage School District has created a searchable database that makes it easy to find out specific information about how Anchorage students are doing. As Chief Academic Officer Mike Graham told the school board this week,
I think this is one of the biggest things we have had, biggest, most valuable tools we've had come to us in, as far as anybody can remember, I mean, probably ever.
The tool makes it easy to highlight specific things, like one quarter of the students at Begich Middle School have received either in-school or out-of-school suspensions, and the number of students attending school 90% of the time is dropping. But Graham says the beauty of the tool isn't just pulling out these little bits. It's being able to see how the data all fit together and use that to develop solutions. School principals already have access to the tool. Graham says even during their initial training on how to use it, they were putting the data to work.
Some of what they saw, they were excited by. Some of it, they were truly jolted by, I guess, and became very concerned to be able to see it right out there. But there were already discussions going between principals about what's happening at that school versus this school, the very things we want to have happen.
Superintendent Dina Paramo says now that the administrators can more easily see what's happening with their students, they can adapt policies, grading methods, and teaching to help them.
The mining of the data in the past was so difficult and took so much time that the time to have to change the business of what we do, we didn't get to. And so now literally we're using efficiencies, we're using technology to be able to answer some of the questions that we have.
Part of the answers are spelled out in a plan to increase graduation rates. The plan focuses on students who receive Fs and have low attendance, two indicators that a student is less likely to finish school. The plan also includes outreach to the community. Promo says national data show that 70% of people who do not finish high school never move more than 10 miles from those schools.
So if we don't pay attention to high school graduation rates, these students become members of our community that will find it very difficult to earn a livable wage and to participate and be community members. So it is not just a school district, it should be all of our goals that in Anchorage we want kids to graduate.
The data dashboard will be available to the public in about 6 weeks. The district needs to modify it so people will not be able to identify individual students. It's possible to narrow the data by school, gender, ethnic group, grade, and more. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The abundant cultural diversity of Alaska's largest city has inspired a new collaboration between Anchorage and an artist co-op. The goal is to improve the community through creativity and collaboration. Alaska Public Media's Ammon Swenson has more.
Located in downtown Anchorage, in a space that once held a Starbucks, the Anchorage Artist Co-op could be mistaken for just another art gallery. An eclectic mix of floor-to-ceiling murals cover the walls and two life-size bear sculptures stand in the middle of the floor. But there's a lot more going on than just visual art on display. Outside, dozens of people have stopped by on a Thursday evening to watch breakdancers perform while a DJ blasts music from a PA. The KeyBank Plaza is temporarily transformed from a sleepy corporate space into a hive of pounding beats and kinetic energy. Special Assistant to the Mayor, George Martinez, takes over the mic. He's traded his business suit for a t-shirt, jeans, and sunglasses.
Seems like we're having a lot of fun, but I want everybody to be aware this is a historic night. This is the first time this space has been activated in this way. So we're making history tonight, and we're going to keep that moving forward. Positive energy in the streets, community engagement, and lots of love in downtown Anchorage.
He's referring to what the co-op calls their Thursday Night Cypher, what they hope will be a weekly collaborative art event that showcases the culture and creativity of Anchorage. In addition to breakdancers, they've also showcased custom lowrider cars. Martinez sees a partnership between the co-op and the city as a means to develop a sustainable ecosystem for local artists and in turn tap into that creativity to benefit the city.
This is an innovative potential way to integrate artists economically, let alone informationally, to the city, but then also we all harness this together, grows potential tourism and just increases and supports that tourism traffic, which also grows the opportunity for our local artists to have access to different markets.
While this idea of incorporating the city's artists in the basic infrastructure of Anchorage is in its early stages, Martinez says that the possibilities are nearly endless. There are the typical goals, such as decorating building exteriors, and the less obvious, such as using artists to reimagine how crosswalks can be designed to be both aesthetically pleasing and safer. The co-op has been working with the Youth Advisory Commission and the Anchorage Downtown Partnership for various art projects and workshops. Recently, the co-op participated in painting a mural downtown on 5th and D. Other art displays in public spaces are in the works as well. Lee Post is on the co-op's steering committee and is using his experience as an artist and his career counseling youth to help people find their way into the arts.
I really want to take away any perceived barriers that somebody can take part in the Anchorage art scene. That basically, if you can make art, if you take even the first baby step into creating something, there's going to be a place for you, and there's going to be, the city's going to be receptive and help you develop.
Even though it was the first night of the event, the crowd was responsive. Passersby would occasionally join in. A key bank employee even stopped to bust some moves before heading out. It's the type of involvement with the public and the artists that the co-op hopes to see ultimately help make a positive impact. I'm Ammon Swenson in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight. Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Alaska is earthquake country, but many people don't know how to prepare for an earthquake. The Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management wants to change that. The division hopes to jolt people into awareness with a mobile earthquake simulator. The Quake Cottage is scheduled to visit 10 communities in Southeast Alaska and the Yukon for the first time ever this fall. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
From a distance, the Quake Cottage looks like a normal enclosed trailer you hook up to the back of a truck. But get closer and you see the words, Alaska's Earthquake Simulator. Are you ready for the next big quake? Step inside and it sounds like this.
This is not a ride. It is an experience.
The Quake Cottage holds four people. You sit down and hold on tight as the shaking starts. Jeremy Zittick with Alaska Homeland Security says the machine can simulate up to an 8.0 magnitude earthquake.
The earthquake simulator is an experience that we want people here in Alaska to get a chance to feel because earthquakes are so prevalent.
Alaska is the most seismically active region in the U.S. and even one of the most seismically active in the world. According to the Alaska Earthquake Center, there have been more than 22,000 quakes in the state so far this year. Most of those are minor, but Zittick says his agency wants you to be prepared for the next big one.
The danger of earthquakes here in Alaska is very real.
That's why Alaska Homeland Security owns one of the few quake cottages in existence. It's a prevention tool. It's meant to bring home the reality of what an earthquake feels like and that it could happen to you.
The experience is a little bit jarring, but that's what an earthquake is. An earthquake can be a very violent event, and people should know what to do when that shaking starts.
CNN anchor Anderson Cooper had a jarring experience when he tried out one of the quake cottages in 2012.
All right, should we go?
Okay, let's shake it up.
All right.
Okay.
You ready?
Here
ready.
We go.
Okay.
Ready?
Whoa. Oh. Wow.
Zittick says the best earthquake safety advice for people in the U.S. is drop, cover, and hold. Get on the ground, find cover from falling objects, and hold on while you wait the earthquake out.
It's more of the turtle philosophy as opposed to the rabbit philosophy. You really can't run from the earthquake anyways. If you run outside, there's just as many falling hazards that can hurt you there, and there's a good likelihood that you're going to be thrown to the ground.
Zittick says people in Southeast Alaska have been asking for the quake cottage for a while. The division hasn't been able to bring the simulator to any off-the-road communities because it's an expensive endeavor. But late this summer and fall, it's finally going to happen with the help of grant funding.
In Southeast, people are vulnerable to earthquakes and tsunamis, so they need to know what to do when they feel that shaking.
One of the Southeast Alaska residents pushing for the simulator to visit this region is Craig resident Brian Templin.
Because of our location on the coast and the threat of earthquakes, it's one of those things that we've been very fortunate. But you certainly want to be prepared.
Templin is involved in Craig's emergency planning committee. He says the simulator's visit will coincide with the town's biennial emergency preparedness fair. The Quake Cottage tour of the Yukon and Southeast is scheduled to start in Whitehorse August 26th and travel to Skagway, Juneau, Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, Craig, Haines, and Haines Junction, in that order. Zittick hopes the month-long tour will help Southeast Alaskans be prepared for when the next major earthquake strikes. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
For decades, University of Washington scientists have studied Bristol Bay salmon. Now the researchers are studying what happens upstream from a slightly different perspective. The bears. University of Washington's Fishery Research Institute has a project looking at where, when, and even how bears catch salmon on Lake Alegnigik streams. KDLG's Molly Dishner tagged along to check the camera traps on Happy Creek and brought back this story.
Walk up a salmon stream in Bristol Bay, and although the bear sign is evident, you might not see one fishing. But researchers with the University of Washington's Alaska Salmon Program have found a way to study the bears when they do come out, with cameras activated by movement and barbed wires to snag bear hair. It takes about an hour or so to check the traps at Happy and marvel at the sheer number of salmon swimming upstream to spawn. On a normal day, the team checks about half the Alaknik streams they're studying.
What's this one? Barb 15?
Yeah. 15.
So this is Happy Wire 1, one of the first wires that ever went up. First time we put it up, we returned 2 days later and the whole thing had been trampled on. It was all bent out of shape, but there was probably 30 hair samples on it. So we said, oh,
good spot,
this is good, this is going to work. And what was the time?
That was Aaron Worsing. He works with the Alaska Salmon Program, based at the University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute for the summer. The group has studied bear predation and its impacts on salmon for more than a decade. In 2010, they decided to use cameras to see what bears were up to when humans weren't around. Since then, they've added genetics to also get a unique ID for the bears.
And since 2012, not including this year, we've detected over 120 different bears just on six streams. And that's just detected. So we can use those numbers to actually estimate how many bears use these streams.
The setup is relatively simple, if a little time-intensive to check. Six streams, barbed wire stretched across each in two spots to snag bear hair. That hair is used for genetics testing to ID the bears. And at each of the wires, there's a motion-activated camera. Some of the streams also have an extra camera to see a little more bear action.
And one of the nice things about being able to match up the wires and the cameras is the cameras are kind of an independent check of whether the wires work. So if we photograph a bear near the wire, does it leave hair? In most cases, it does. So I think the wires do a very good job of detecting a bear, if you will, if it's in the area. And it also just plays upon the natural behavior of bears. The stream is the path of least resistance and has all their food in it. So I think they move up and down the streams, which means if we span a string of barbed wire across, we have a good chance of snagging hair from most of the streams, bears that are on these streams, yeah. Mm-hmm.
While Worsing and the research tech carefully remove all the hairs from the wires, Anne Hilborn, another researcher, takes memory cards out of the cameras.
One of the things about the camera traps is it shows you how many bears are here
and the exact same places we're walking. It's a little sobering sometimes. But they
have soon after.
Yeah. Because the photos are time stamped. You can see the bears and then you see us come up and then you see more bears come in.
The cameras are adjustable and Hilborn has changed how sensitive they are and how long they record to try and get the best bear imagery. Sometimes other animals still show up. Moose, porcupines, fox, a mink, and lots of birds.
A heavy day will be several hundred clips, of which maybe four or five will have bears on them and the rest is branches and grass and things. But and we actually found on this creek that the salmon are setting off the camera. And so we've got 600 clips of salmon going up the creek as well, which is actually could provide a bunch of interesting information about when the salmon actually first come in, what direction they go, because sometimes they go back out for a while.
Despite those potential salmon studies, for now the project remains focused on bears. It is, however, expanding in location. UW's salmon program has added camera traps at Lake Nerka, and collaborators with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are working on other sites in Wood-Tikchik State Park and Dillingham. Back at FRI's camp on Lake Aleknagik, Hilborn starts going through the videos.
Oh, here we go.
It's a bear!
Hey! So he went under it. And I think this looks like a bear that I've seen on this creek before, but you can't really prove it. Come watch this, Aaron.
It's great.
We got your culprit.
Perfect, look at that. It went right there. That's excellent. Show Blakely. That's an awesome piece of video.
Oh.
And then he gets a fish.
Nice.
Oh, that's super footage. Yeah.
Just a couple hundred more clips to watch. But as the researchers tell me, if there's one or two as exciting as those, it's worth every minute of watching wind blow through grass. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman and Ammon Swenson in Anchorage, Emily Files in Haines, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.